Welcome back to Open Line. Bob Singleton sitting in for Fred Anderle on WOSU 820. This hour, all good parents want their children to succeed, but what if success comes at the expense of childhood? Our guest this hour says it's time to stop pushing so hard, to slow down, trust our instincts, enjoy our kids. Carl Honoré studied history and Italian at Edinburgh University, then he switched course to work with street children in Brazil. His first book, In Praise of Slowness, was an international bestseller. His new book is Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. From Denver, welcome to Open Line, Carl Honoré.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Tell us, what exactly is hyperparenting?
Well, I think of hyperparenting as good parenting run amok, in the sense that it starts from a noble and natural instinct, which is the impulse to do the best for our children. But I think in the last generation, that has tipped into something a bit like caricature, where now we feel as parents that we are under pressure to push, polish, and protect our kids with superhuman zeal. We feel we must give them the best of everything and make them at the same time the best at everything. You want them to be an academic, an athlete, an artist, and to be top of the class in all of those. And there's a feeling out there for parents, especially nowadays, that somehow child rearing is all or nothing. You know, that you only an alpha child can survive, that your kid, after he's born, faces two tracks open to him. And the first is, you know, that he's in Mensa by nine, he's a Rhodes Scholar, Ivy League, and then he's on the front cover of Time magazine. Or, you know, track two, he's sleeping rough under a bridge. And that, I think that creates a kind of basic heartbeat of anxiety in a lot of homes now, so that we feel that we're never doing enough as parents, and we shift into this kind of slightly hyper and over-anxious mode and end up doing too much, I think.
You cite an experience with one of your own children. In fact, it led to your writing this book. He's 7 years old. He likes to draw. And you start talking about art school.
Well, that's right. Well, it wasn't enough, but he liked to draw. I mean, it was, for me, the wake-up call, the moment that set me on the path to write this book was at a parent-teacher evening. And it was a very familiar scene. I'm sure your listeners will recognize it. You know, I'm perched on that very low plastic seat on the ground, hanging on every word from the teacher, waiting for a pearl of praise to fall into my lap so I can punch the air in triumph and breathe a sigh of relief. And the feedback was good, but it wasn't, there was nothing sort of stellar about it, nothing to make you stand up and beat your chest, until I got to the art room and the art teacher was just gushing about my little boy. And she said, you know, oh, he's wonderful, he's creative, he's imaginative. And look, here on the wall we have a sketch that he's done, and we have it up there as a model for other pupils. And then she dropped what I think of as the G-bomb. She said, your son is a gifted young artist. And it was, you know, I heard that word, gifted, and suddenly I didn't hear anything else. I went straight home from school that night. And I hopped on Google and I started looking for an art course or an art camp or an art tutor to take this gift and polish it, you know, to turn my son's art into an achievement. And I went to bed that night with a big smile on my face, envisioning, you know, raising the next Picasso. And I walked to school with him the next morning and I said, you know, what do you think? I found this great art tutor who's going to help you draw even better. And he just stopped there on the sidewalk and he looked at me and said, I don't want an art tutor. You know, I love to draw, and that's enough. I don't want a tutor. And then he asked me the question that I think of as the coup de grace. And he said, why do grown-ups always have to take over everything? And it was one of those awful moments of searing epiphany when you suddenly see yourself in sharp relief. And I thought, whoa, you know, he's right. I am trying to take over. And I'm becoming one of those pushy parents you read about in the Sunday newspapers. And that for me was the real turning point and set me off on this journey to investigate where childhood is around the world and to see if we can make some more sense of it.
Well, I don't know how his art career is going to work out, but
well, we'll find out.
He'll always have this, just that one. He's the kid that launched a book, and there's not every kid can say that.
Yeah, I better not tell him that, though, because it'll hang over his head like some dark cloud, the sword of Damocles there.
You write, wherever you look these days, the message is the same. Childhood's too precious to be left to children, and children are too precious to be left alone. All this meddling is forging a new kind of childhood, the age of the managed child. What do you mean by that?
Well, it seems to me that we've stumbled into a very unique moment in the history of childhood where we are micromanaging every detail of our children's lives. And that is not just parents, that's the whole culture. And it is wherever you look now. You look at the way school systems have become a bit like conveyor belts, where children are stuffed with academic learning earlier and earlier, and then tested and tested over and over again, so that the marks and the grades become more important than learning itself. Or look also at the way that officialdom is strangling children with safety regulations at every turn, you know, banning high-risk activities like snowball fights or tag or even marbles from school grounds. And, you know, look at the way also that advertisers and the whole kind of consumer juggernaut has pushed its way into every corner of childhood now, and you find, you know, marketing surveyors holding sleepovers for kids and stalking them in their bedrooms and playgrounds and trying to work out what their buying habits will be. And, of course, the technology is a part of this, too. You have kids now going to school with GPS tracking devices in their school bags, or, you know, you pick up magazines now, or you go into people's homes and they have cameras in the nursery to look after their, keep an eye on their babies, or cameras around the house to keep an eye on their teens. And there's just this almost a kind of big brother element in the air, it seems to me, that we feel that we have to be hovering. And that's, people talk about helicopter parenting. I think that image sums up a lot of where we are, not only as parents, but as adults and as a whole society, is that we feel we need to be hovering overhead at every turn, and we can't just back off and give kids that time and space that actually they genuinely need.
You write, many children now keep the kind of schedule that would make a CEO queasy. One California mother bought her son a Palm Pilot to help him keep track of his extracurricular activities. Piano, baseball, Spanish, basketball, soccer, tennis, swimming, and karate. I get tired just reading this list. He's so busy, he needs to learn how to manage his time, she says, and her child is 10 years old.
Yes, I mean, and I think there'll be an uncomfortable ring of familiarity for a lot of people in that. I'm 40, and I know that a lot of people of my generation had a very different experience of childhood. It was a kind of free-range experience, where, you know, you did a few structured adult supervised extracurricular activities, but most or certainly much of your time was adult free, and you roamed the neighborhood. You got kicked out of the house in the morning, and then at lunchtime you could hear your mom shouting from a few streets away. You went back for lunch, and then you got kicked out again in the afternoon until the same thing happened at dinner. And I think that was a very different experience of growing up than a lot of children have today, where everything feels like it has to be structured. It has to be supervised. It has to be organized. You know, it's even burned into our vernacular now. It's the case that children no longer just play. They have a play date. You know, it's formalized. It's in the planner. It involves driving people from A to B. It involves parents being on site. And I think that has spread out from just the simple idea of play to the way we approach everything. I mean, you look at the school playing fields around, you know, any city in the United States, you know, 20 years ago, they would have been full of kids just playing pickup sports, you know, taking a football out there and playing 4-on-4, or kicking a soccer ball around, or playing a bit of sandlot baseball. Now those fields are either empty, or the kids are there in uniforms, playing with a rule book, playing under the watchful gaze of coaches who are telling them exactly what to do and screaming at them when they make mistakes. And often you find on the sidelines parents arrayed in a kind of Greek chorus of vitriol, you know, hollering and howling themselves hoarse, telling the child what to do, and again, hovering at every turn. And I think that's, I mean, you look around, and I think that there's a kind of stultifying quality to that. I'm not against organized activities. I think they have a role to play in every childhood. But we've lost, I think, our bearings a little bit, and we've tipped too far in the other direction, so that we've squeezed out those moments of unscheduled time, unsupervised time, adult-free time that are so essential and such a fundamental part of a childhood well-lived.
It's something I've noticed. I'm not a parent myself, but I see kids. They're all over the place. But one thing I've noticed, all of a sudden, the last few years, every kid has a, it's not just a book bag, it's a backpack. they're burdened. They've got these huge things strapped to their back, and they're just loaded down with stuff that they've got to carry everywhere. And that alone must be exhaustive for a child these days. Does that have anything to do with this situation we're talking about?
I think it's another dimension of the same problem, in that in schools now we are piling on the work. And I think that this is very much a cultural bias that we have at the moment, that this notion that if something is good, then more of it must be better. And if something is good, then the earlier you get it, the better. And so you see kids, you know, 6-, 7-, 8-year-olds struggling to school, as you say, under these knapsacks that are bulging with books and textbooks. And then even after school, they come home with homework now. You know, you're getting kids with homework at the age of 5, 6, and 7, which would have been unthinkable a generation ago. And even when you look at the research into what the value of homework, it's pretty hard to find anything compelling to back up the case that homework is of really much use for kids under about the age of 11. And yet there we are shoveling it on, you know, driven forward by this idea that earlier is better and more is more. And you use the word exhausted. And I think that that's a kind of keynote of modern childhood now, is fatigue, that a lot of kids are just tired. And you hear this from doctors and counselors and anyone who's on the front line dealing with a lot of the fallout from where we are with childhood now. And they describe the same phenomenon right across the U.S. and right across the world, that of seeing tired kids. You know, a generation ago, you didn't see exhausted 9-year-olds. Now you do. And part of that is just the pressure that is piled on them. But there are other things going on here, too, that there are many more distractions and stimulations in the average bedroom and household now than there were before. I mean, you've got a lot of kids go to their bedroom at the end of the day, and it resembles the flight deck of the Starship Enterprise. You know, it's full of PlayStations and Nintendos and beeps and whistles and computer screens. And so kids disappear into that world and are getting a lot less sleep than they did as well. So it's not uncommon nowadays to see young children with, you know, big black circles under their eyes and falling asleep in the back of the car between extracurricular activities because they're just worn out.
Listeners, do you have a child? Are you a hyper parent? What do you think about this conversation? If you'd like to join in, we've got a line for you at 292-8513, 292-8513. Our guest is Carl Honoré. His new book, Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. You can reach us on the web if you've got an email question you'd like to pass along. We're at WOSU.org. Well, we touched on fatigue. There are other problems that you've noticed. Cooped up like chickens with little exercise and high-calorie diets, children are growing dangerously fat. We know that, but I didn't know it was because we have hyper parents. I thought it was just because we ate too much.
We're all getting too fat. That's absolutely true. But I think there's no question that the rising rates of obesity among the young, one reason for that is that they spend less time just charging around outdoors. It's a very much an indoor culture. And it's very interesting. I do a lot of public events now, and if you ask people to look back at their childhood now, and you ask parents who are, again, of my generation, you know, 35 and up, and ask them to recall their memories of childhood, what were their most fond and vivid memories? And almost invariably, they answer with moments or activities that involve being outdoors.
It's when that screen door slams behind you as you run out of the house, into the yard, and on into the world. That was being a kid.
That's such an evocative image and sound. You said the screen door slamming, and suddenly I was 9 years old again, hearing the screen door. That hits it right on the head. And yet you ask people at public events now, and you talk to children who are under, I'd say, around the age of sort of 20, and you get a very different answer, that their most vivid memories of growing up are of being indoors, you know, of being places which are, you know, climate-controlled, sterilized, and usually with adults hovering around calling all the shots. And it's a very profound shift in the way we're rearing our children. We've moved away from that kind of free-range approach to almost like a battery hen approach to child rearing. And I think it's pretty clear that one of the fallouts from that is this rising obesity, because children just simply spend a lot more time indoors, and that means sitting down, and that means very much closer to the kitchen, and all of these things come together to create this enlarging waistline.
Carl Honore, I think you struck a chord. Our switchboard, or my switchboard, is lighting up. Let's go to some callers. We've got Margaret. Hello, Margaret. Welcome to Open Line.
Hi there. I'm a grandmother raising my grandchildren, and my son grew up very much like your guest has described. But the original comment I had was that I have a grandson in kindergarten now, and he literally had homework. And that was so hard for me to, as a grandparent, oversee and to make him come in from outdoors to do that work when I had no conviction that he needed to do that. And I just thought that having homework and writing and bringing home books, especially on the weekend, was just counterproductive to everything I stood for. So just a comment for you.
I think that's Margaret. Hello. Thanks for calling. And I couldn't agree more. And the question is almost a rhetorical one. Is the natural habitat for a five-year-old boy sitting at a desk working on his pencil control and poring over times tables, or is it outside in the backyard chasing a ball around or digging up holes in the garden? And I think we all know the answer to that. But the problem, of course, is that the whole system has been rejigged in this other direction, which is about turning everything into a measurable task, doing things earlier. And homework is a perfect, in some ways, I think, a perfect metaphor for where we're going wrong. Because when you drill down into the whole world of homework, it is almost impossible to find research that validates giving kids homework at that age, because it does all the things that you're talking about there. It can put them off schoolwork. It can make school a drag. It takes them away from the valuable, simple, free play that is the driving force of child development. And it doesn't deliver better academic results, and yet we keep on doing it. I'm so glad to hear you speak out against it. And I want to say that you're not alone, and this is a conversation that's going on in households around the United States, but around the world as well. And I think that the pendulum has reached the other extreme now, and it is starting to come back. In fact, in last month in Toronto, in Canada, that city became the first jurisdiction in North America to say, this has gone too far. We've got to pull this homework juggernaut back. And they've started cutting homework officially right across the school system now for next year at every grade level, especially the younger kids. So even officialdom is starting to wake up to the folly of this approach to education, especially in the early years. And it can change. I mean, I am a glass half full kind of guy, and my book, ultimately, we've been talking about a lot of the bad stuff, but ultimately my book is a hopeful one, and it's looking at the many ways in which people are pulling back, easing off, and giving children that time and space. And that things like what happened in Toronto last month are a hopeful marker. And I think that, you know, the more parents talk about it, the more they go into the school and challenge the teacher and say, what is the point of this homework? Show me the evidence this works. That will start to and even talking to your congressmen, your local representatives, government officials, and making this change. It can change. It will change, I think.
Margaret.
On the other hand, I see that kids are not reading like my generation did, like my son's generation did. You know, the homework has nothing to do with sitting down and reading a good book at all.
No, I think that's true. I think that there are two problems with the homework epidemic, and I know that's a slightly alarmist word to use, but I think it's a fair one in this case. There are two problems with the way we approach homework now. One is just the simple volume of it, the bulk, the number of hours it chews up in an average child's week. The other is the nature of the homework. And I think a lot of the homework that comes home with kids is just pointless. It's busy work. It's ticking boxes. It's little easy packages of tasks and work that are easy for the teacher to grade and to compare against one child against the other. But they're ultimately not that useful. It's much harder to grade or to measure or to benchmark or to put a target on a child sitting for a couple of hours and just reading a story that they find engrossing. So we're not encouraging them to do that, but that skill is a hugely useful one, especially, I think, in this world where we're moving more and more towards sound bites and everything is parceled up into tiny little packages. We need to hold on to that very powerful and very creative skill that is deep reading, really disappearing into an idea, following an idea and an argument all the way through from the beginning to end, because we need that as a counterweight now against this, you know, mouse-click Google generation where everything happens in two lines and then you move on.
Margaret, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
The book we're discussing is Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. Our guest is the author, Carl Honoré, and we have Gary. Welcome to Open Line, Gary.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
Yeah, I just turned on the radio, and I like to listen to Open Line. And I have a daughter who is now 19, oh, almost 19. She lives in Florida. She attends college down there. And we went through a very bitter divorce. And for all the time that I tried to keep my daughter apprised of one thing was to keep her reading skills up. And I wanted her to have a balance in her life. She always did computer work. She always did schoolwork and homework, and she seemed to enjoy it. She just finished her first year of college with a 3.5 cum in chemistry. And nobody in our family is what I call extremely bright. But in my opinion, because of the reading that was encouraged by her grandparents and her mother and the habits that her mother's family had as being what I would call voracious readers, has given her a balance that fits the demands of where she's going to be going in the future. And I think parents can contribute so much, but what I tell my daughter is keep the lines of communication open with me. If you have a problem, call me. If you need something, call me. And what I found out is my daughter's become an incredibly independent young woman, and yet she called me the other night and said, "Dad, I just need to talk. I feel so bad about my money's not going as far," and so on and so forth. So I think parents, if they have the right perspective on things, it's not over-parenting, but it's a matter of helping your child stay in the right direction with the right perspective on life and all the changes that are going on right now in the world.
Do we have a response, Carl?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting here, you can't see me, but I'm nodding because everything you say makes perfect sense. And there's a word that I'd pluck out of your talk there, which is balance. And that's really what this is all about. I mean, I'm certainly not talking about moving from whatever you want to call it, hyper-parenting, to the opposite extreme, which is complete laissez-faire, let them drop. I mean, real parenting is about being fully engaged and sometimes, you know, rolling up your sleeves, and it's hard work. I'm not saying that it's not. So I think it's about finding the right equilibrium, the right equilibrium that suits your family. And I think this is very important nowadays, that we've lost confidence, I think, as parents, and find ourselves turning to the gurus and the advice industry, and that tends to give one formula, and it gives the impression that there's one way to do things, and that can be very limiting and stifling, and also counterproductive, because there isn't one way of parenting. There's so many different styles and so many different balance points in there, and I think what we need to do as parents is close out a lot of the sound and fury that surrounds modern childhood, and just be quiet with ourselves and try and find that inner voice that leads you to what Gary, I think it is, isn't it?
Yes.
Was describing, which is finding your own way and finding that right, getting the scales right so that your child knows when he or she can come to you for help, but also knows that there are times to stand on his or her own two feet. And that's a very difficult balance to find, but it's a balance that's there, and it's one I think we should be aspiring to. And I think more and more people are now and are maybe trying to back away from this overzealous, overwrought approach.
Gary, thank you for your call. I have
sure,
we have to go away for some brief program announcements, but we'll be back with our guest in about a minute and a half on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, author of the bestseller Taliban, talks about his new book, Descent into Chaos, the U.S. and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. And we talk with New York Times business correspondent Jonah Serra. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins later this afternoon at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 79 degrees at 10:30. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. If you're one of the thousands of people in Central Ohio that use an antenna to get TV, you'll need to upgrade when television goes all digital in 2009. Learn more about the switch to digital. Visit wosu.org/DTV or call 292-9678. And don't forget that weekday mornings you can prepare for the day with Morning Edition, starting at 5 a.m., now on WOSU 89.7 FM. In the forecast for today for Central Ohio, partly sunny skies, a slight chance of showers, and a high of 89. Mostly clear tonight and muggy, a low of 68. Sunny for Friday and humid with a high of 92. More sunshine on Saturday with a slight chance of rain. Humid again for Saturday with a high of 88. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line. Bob Singleton sitting in for Fred Anderle. This hour, we're discussing parenting and childhood. Our guest is Carl Honoré. He is the author of the book, Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. And we have a caller. I want to go. He's been waiting too long. We have Daniel. Welcome to Open Line, Daniel.
Well,
hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
I'm 54 years old, so I grew up in Ohio in the 50s and 60s, and, you know, all our neighbors were packed in tight, and I agree with everything you said, that parents just said, okay, go off, and would run around, and they'd call us in, you know, yell at us for dinner or whatever. But, you know, I was wondering if maybe the way we're raising kids today is a bit of a reaction to the way parents were raised when they were kids, where it was totally hands-off, and the parents were not so involved. Maybe we've overreacted a little bit in the way we're micromanaging kids today. That was one point. The other thing is talking about teaching, and my wife is a middle school language arts teacher, and they talk about teaching to the test in her middle school all the time, and that the No Child Left Behind thing has been, it's hated by a lot of teachers, I'll tell you that. But I don't think it teaches them to be creative. They just drill this stuff into them so the test scores look good, so the school system looks good, because, you know, you look at the Columbus Dispatch, and every so often all the schools are rated. Here's the schools, and here's how the kids did on the test, over and over like that. So,
can you narrow this down? Did you have a specific question?
Well, one thing, do you think it's an overreaction
okay.
to the way we were raised as kids, the way we micromanage? And then the teaching to the test thing. And the other thing that, you know, we talk about is the way the houses are and the way we're growing up now. We have such suburban sprawl that, you know, we're spread out all over the place, and you have to get in your car to do anything.
That's right. If you want to go play in the woods, it's a drive to the woods, isn't it?
It's a drive, yeah. And, I mean, you talked about the sports and stuff. I have kids, friends of ours, who have kids on soccer teams, and they're on these club teams, and they're traveling to outside of Ohio to states all over the place. They're traveling all over, and I keep asking, don't tell me there are not enough good soccer players in Ohio that they don't have to drive 5 hours. You know, their whole weekend is shot because they're going to Indiana or Kentucky for a soccer tournament.
What do you think, Carl?
Well, thanks, Daniel. I mean, there's a lot there to unpack. I mean, certainly the question of teaching to the test, that's something now you hear around the world in classrooms and schoolyards and playgrounds. And I think it's a symptom of the broader culture. We find it very hard to let things happen nowadays. There's a kind of management consultant mania around everything we do. We want everything to be measurable and comparable, and numbers and graphs and so on. And I think that's inimical to a lot of learning, because a lot of learning is open-ended, it's fuzzy, it's blurry, and it's hard to measure. And kids, you know, learn at different rates, and they learn in different ways. So to try and create a single exam that becomes the only benchmark for a child's worth and the worth of the teacher and the worth of the whole school, it seems to me completely at odds with everything we know about education, but yet that's where we are now. And you find I mean, you mentioned the Columbus, Ohio, the newspaper there, and the. I mean, that's the same again in so many countries now. It's almost like reading the sports section. You know, you go and you see the you see the baseball scores, you see the hockey standings for the league, and then you look at the school standings, and these things don't tell you very much. They tell you, and a system geared this way tells you ultimately how good children are at passing exams. And how useful is that, in especially in this new economy where we're looking for people to be creative, to think across disciplines, to learn for the sake of it rather than just to tick a box. So I think we've gone very wrong there, but things are starting to change again on that front, and I think we can pull it around. The question of whether this micromanagement culture now is a reaction against the more laissez-faire approach of the last generation, that's an interesting point. I think that certainly when you look through all of history, you see a kind of ebb and flow, that the style of child rearing, the pendulum swings back and forth, often as a reaction to what happened in the generation before. But I think that that's not so much the case this time around, not least because we're micromanaging in an extreme form. And in the last generation, I don't think we were laissez-faire in an extreme form. I mean, I talked about being kicked outdoors and so on and given a lot of free time. But, you know, my parents were also very hands-on and were very present and did push me sometimes. So it wasn't like it was a complete extreme to the other extreme. What we've stumbled into now is a kind of perfect storm in terms of culture, that various cultural trends have intersected at the same moment of history to create this unique moment in the history of childhood. And I think some of those things are that the consumer culture is much more powerful and pronounced than it's ever been in human history. And that creates this soaring expectations culture where we want everything to be perfect. We want a perfect home, a perfect vacation, perfect teeth, and you know, a perfect child to round out the picture. There's also this, you know, the globalization and the coming down of the Berlin Wall, and that has all introduced more uncertainty in the workplace than we've seen for generations. And that drives both parents and officialdom to push kids to give them what they think is a competitive advantage. And then we've also seen some very unique shifts demographically. So on one hand, you have smaller families than we've ever seen before in history. You know, it's not uncommon now to have one or two children only. And that means by just simple arithmetic, you have a lot more time to plow into each kid. And then the other, just to round out the point, that we are also having kids older than we've ever had them before. And that makes a big difference, too, in two ways. The first is that you think of mothers now who, and this is chiefly a middle-class thing, obviously, but you think of a mother having her first baby at the age of 20 versus a mother having her first baby at the age of 39 and a half. You know, there's a very, very different mindset there for the older mom. She's thinking, you know, I've just skidded in here at the finish line. This is my last chance, maybe. All my eggs are in one basket. I'm going to make this work. So that anxiety is built in from the beginning. But also, both as fathers and mothers, we come to parenting after many years in the workplace, and that changes our approach to child rearing. I think we think, okay, how are we going to parent better? Well, we'll do what we do at work when we want to improve something. We'll bring in the experts, we'll spend a lot of money, and we'll put in long, hard hours at it. You know, we will professionalize parenting. And I think you put all of those things together, and that really explains a lot of what's happening now, rather than a reaction, a simple reaction against what happened in the last generation.
Daniel, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
This hour, we're discussing parenting and childhood. The book, Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. Our guest is the author, Carl Honoré. We have a line for you at 292-8513, 292-8513. You can email us a question at wosu.org. And we have a caller. We have Pam. Welcome to Open Line, Pam.
Hi. Yes, there isn't a single thing that the guest has said that I don't agree with. However, I will say that I am guilty as charged. I am one of those well-intentioned parents that I don't think I'm extreme, but I realize what I'm doing when I'm doing it. I realize the effect on the children. And I want to say that, like, when it comes to the academic arena, I feel like I don't want to do all these things that you have to do, you think you have to do, to remain competitive with the peers. It just seems like it is constantly stated in you know, when I read things, when I listen to things about how competitive it is and how you best be doing this at an early age to get the child ready for this. You just want to give your child the best possible opportunities in life. And so you kind of do what you think you should be doing, even though you feel it isn't balanced, it isn't right. And then also to talk about, like, playing and just safety. That's my big thing, is playing outdoors and safety. I mean, I have children that are 15, 12, and 8, and I would love to just say go, which is what I did when I was a kid. And my parents were very protective, but it was safe. You could just go, and you could go play in the field, and there was no problem. The other day, my 12-year-old wanted to go, you know, to the next neighborhood, to an elementary school, and play on the playground, which was quite a distance from the house, and I wanted to say, yeah, go, but I just didn't feel like it was safe to do that. So my question is, what recommendations do you have for parents that are struggling with this?
Thanks, Pam. When you talked about the safety being the toughest thing for you, I that really resonates with me, because through all of this pulling apart of where we are with childhood and trying to make sense of what the way to go forward is, for me, the hardest thing as well is the safety angle. And I think that's because in all of this kind of media hysteria that surrounds children, it's the fear side of it that's most acute and that hits us deepest as parents. And, you know, a part of why we feel so afraid now is just really the way the media has changed over the last generation. I mean, we've gone from a world where you had, you know, not very many channels and a bit of news and some newspapers to a kind of wall of sound, you know, 24-hour news cycles. A child disappears in southern Florida, and it's all over the newspapers. You're watching live coverage of the parents crying in Columbus, Ohio, you know, and you might be watching it for day after day after day. And I think it creates this expectation or this belief that there's a pedophile around every corner, that the traffic is much more dangerous than it's ever been, when in fact the facts are that that's in many neighborhoods that's just simply not the case, that the crime rates for child abuse are no higher than they've been before. We just get a lot more coverage of it, and that in a lot of neighborhoods, you know, that with traffic calming measures and cars being more sophisticated and having better braking systems, in a lot of neighborhoods the traffic in the outdoor urban landscape is actually safer. The trouble is, for parents, it just doesn't feel that way. You know,
one thing that's interesting that you say that, because I've always wondered that. Do we have more pedophiles today than we had, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago?
I don't
really know. I really personally don't know the answer to that. But I feel like me as a parent today, I don't feel like other parents want me to look out for their children like they did when I was growing up. They all knew each other. We all knew each other. We knew the neighborhood. My mom and dad knew all the kids and their names. Here today in my neighborhood, there are oodles of people. I have no clue what their names are. I don't even know that some of them have children.
Yeah.
And, you know, so this is very odd to me, living in an environment like this. So I feel like other people are not looking out for my children. Thus, I have to be more vigilant in protecting them from whatever may be out there.
Maybe out there, yeah.
Could we zero in on this, Carl? You mentioned, you said almost exactly the same thing in your book. At one point, you're talking about parenthood is at risk of becoming a rat race of panic, guilt, and disappointment, making us less likely to worry about the welfare of other children or even to trust them. I wanted to ask you about that, and now Pam has brought it up. What exactly are you talking about here?
Well,
why are we less likely to worry about the welfare of other children?
Well, I think that one of the corollaries of this hyper-parenting culture is that we become obsessed with our own kids. We turn inward, and we turn inward in a way that Pam has just described, where the house, the home, becomes like a fortress. You don't go outside. You don't know your neighbors. You know your neighbors' cars better than you know your neighbors themselves. And so we look inwards, and I think the flip side of that, or a corollary of that, is that we look at other children, and they look like the enemy. They look like a rival. We become less interested in their well-being. They become, you know, they become another player in this rat race. And I think we end up in this deeply and depressingly atomized society where we live in these communities where we don't know. I mean, the three houses down, there may be children of the same age as ours, and we don't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a big, big problem. It's part of a bigger shift that's occurred over the last generation or so in around the States, but, you know, beyond. And I think when you talk about how to tackle this culture of fear, that's a big part of the, you know, that's a big first step, is to start rethinking how we live in our communities and, you know, trying to do things more locally and reaching out, having a street barbecue that brings people together and getting to know that family six houses down and finding out that there are children there. And also another way to tackle this fear, I think, is and I've found this with a lot of families, is that it's just simply to go out and walk that route. You talked about your child wanting to go to that playground in the elementary school a little distance away. I don't know if you've ever walked that route. Perhaps you've driven it, but maybe you walk that route the first time with your child. And,
yeah.
And a lot of people – sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I walk that route all the time, And all I see is cars going by, and that makes me even more nervous because I don't see a whole lot of people outside. There's walkers like me, but there's also a lot of people you just don't know, and you just don't know what their intentions might be. And I appreciate the suggestion, and I agree with it, and I want to do it. I think it does start with parents, though, because I describe the winter time around here as people's garage door goes up and their garage door goes down in the winter. For 6 months, that is what we experience in my neighborhood, and it's just suburbia, your typical suburbia, and parents don't communicate with each other. But I can tell the children are different. They do want to interact with one another, and they're restricted a lot of times because of the parents.
It's absolutely right that the parents are an important part of turning this around. And another thing that I find is that trying to break free from this mindset is very hard to do alone, and that it's much easier to do it with other parents doing the same thing. So you find parents, find another family that feel the same way, and then the first few times that your child wants to go to that playground, they go with the other child, or you go with the other, just so that, that feeling of safety in numbers, it's a natural human instinct to want to have people around you. And I know with my own children that when they first took those steps of going across a road on their own and so on, that it just felt a lot more relaxed, and we were let more easy with it, knowing that they were with other children. And it's, what we're talking about here is reinventing our communities as well, and the family is just one piece of that puzzle. But you can't fix one without fixing the bigger picture. So anytime you talk about where we are with parenting or childhood, it immediately tips you into a bigger discussion about where we are culturally, which is kind of what I'm looking at.
Pam, I've got to move on, but thank you. Thank you for your
call.
Thank you.
And we have Anna. Welcome to Open Line, Anna.
Yes, good morning. Got in late here on conversation. I think safety is definitely a concern of parents today, and I think that part of the reason that parents have this fear is due to the criminal justice system. So many of the pedophiles are back out on the streets. We know that that's seldom a curable condition, and I think that promotes a lot of the fear. But in child raising, I see so many families. Now, I'm an older grandmother, I should say. Most of my friends were concerned that the children are given too many choices at too early of an age, and it makes them insecure. And it also involves the parents in a micromanagement that is so tiring to the parents. And it doesn't really promote much of anything. I like choice, but within reason, not do you want eggs today for breakfast, but how would you like your eggs today? Children are choosing restaurants they want to go to for dinner. Well, then you have multiple children, and that creates attention.
What do you think, Carl? Too many choices at too early an age?
I think that's a systemic problem, isn't it? That we're all confronted by too many choices, and a lot of the research shows that the more choice you get, the more stressed you get.
Yeah.
And that we all have an experience of going to the supermarket and you're standing in an aisle and you want to get some cereal, and there are 300 types of cereal, and not only does it take time, it's just the anxiety of you want to choose the right cereal, and then you go home and you wonder if you've got the right one. And I think that to foist that on children at such a young age is counterproductive, and it is tiring. And I think certainly there are times when children just need to be told, this is what you're having. But that seems to run counter not only to our obsessive consumerist culture of choice and giving everybody choice, but it also runs counter to this Peter Pan zeitgeist that's out there at the moment, that this generation of parents, and I count myself in it, we like to think that we're never going to grow old. We dress like kids. We listen to iPods. I rollerblade. I still play a lot of sports. You know, I'm so different from the way my dad was. And in a lot of ways, I dress quite similar to my son, who's now 9. And I think that for our generation, it's a difficult thing to lay down the law. We find discipline a really uncomfortable concept, and we don't like to say no because no seems so authoritarian and old-fashioned and unmodern. We want to, you know, we're in touch with our inner child. And I think part of what changing this whole culture around child rearing involves parents on one side of the equation, because it seems to me we oscillate between doing too much for our kids and not doing enough. And on the too much side is all the pushing and the polishing and the academic grind and the extracurricular scheduling. But on the other side, we don't do enough, and that's the discipline side. That's when we you know, take a stand and say, no, you know, this is what you're going to have for dinner, or it's time to turn off the PlayStation now. You know, we go a bit wobbly and soft on that front. And I think these are two sides of the same coin, and I think you're absolutely right, Anna.
Anna, thank you very much. I got to move on to our next caller. We got Chuck. Hello, Chuck. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Appreciate the conversation very much. It seems to me one of the salient issues, and I'm looking forward to reading the book, may be that it's not going to matter an awful lot what we do to our individual children when it comes to teaching them lots of sports and lots of other things when we have a world situation that is providing a tremendous amount of children that aren't getting anything whatsoever, including food, let alone discipline or a chance to cross the street to play at another school playground. And I think part of what's going on here is we feel insecure in dealing with any of those issues, and we think maybe we can provide our children with the ability to deal with them, but I'm not so sure that that's going to provide any certainty at all, and I'd just like you to address that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck.
Yeah, if I understand right, you're talking about what I think we were touching on earlier, which is that the two sides of the same coin, that we become obsessed with our own children, and the other side of the equation then is we neglect other children. And it seems to me that this whole culture of hyper-parenting, if you like, is polarizing our society and the world in general, so that you have one segment of society that is micromanaged to within an inch of its life, and then the rest of society, which would be the majority, are getting the opposite, that they're underparented, they're not getting enough care, enough help, enough pushing, or enough food, even in many cases. And I think that if we're going to solve both sides of that equation, then somehow we've got to move things into the middle so that the people who are completely absorbed in their own bubble and completely focused, entirely focused on their own children, could be looking more at the other side and reaching out and helping. And I think that, you know, I think that we can't turn this around unless, as a society, we become more open and more fair-minded and more concerned about our fellow man, I mean, ultimately.
You write that micromanaged children can end up struggling to stand on their own two feet.
Yeah.
Academic advisors tell of university students handing over the mobile phone in the middle of interviews and saying, here, why don't you sort this out with my mom?
Yeah.
I can just see that happening, but it's a stunning scenario. Large numbers of middle-class children now choose to live at home well into their 20s. And, well, how do you explain this? I mean, there must be parents out there who would wish that they love their children, but into their 20s?
Wish they'd move out.
Vacate
that spare bedroom. Yeah, well, I think this is one of the part of the fallout from this overmanagement of children is that when they come out the other end of the assembly line that is modern childhood, they really struggle to stand on their own two feet. So you see that at university with that mobile phone scenario, but it doesn't even stop there. I mean, the umbilical cord remains intact, and after graduation, the kids are so tethered to the mothership that you get a lot of parents now turning up for job interviews with their children and helping to negotiate vacation and salary packages, or calling up afterwards and saying, you know, why didn't my daughter get that job? And you know, companies see which way the wind is blowing, and now they're issuing parent packs and having open parent days when mom and dad can come to the office and inspect it to make sure it's okay for junior.
But what does a prospective employer think? Maybe this isn't part of your research, but
well, no, it's not. I look at that. I mean,
across the table, what is your potential boss thinking about this person who can't even carry on a discussion without bringing in the parent?
Well, I think a lot of people in the workplace, a lot of bosses are alarmed by the generation who are now starting to come through, who find it hard to stand on their own two feet, and also who have this. A lot of them, not all obviously, but a lot of them have this sense of entitlement that everything should come on a silver platter. So they arrive, and 6 months later, they expect to be on the board. And if they're not, then maybe mom will be on the phone to find out why not.
You know, this may be an answer that I've been struggling with for quite some time. I don't have a mobile phone. I don't have a cell phone. But it seems like every time I turn around, the person next to me has one, and they're using it. And I've always wondered who in the world they're talking to. And it may well be that they're talking to mom or dad, or maybe both at the same time.
I think they often are, and someone recently described the cell phone as the longest umbilical cord in history, and in some ways I think it is, and I'm not a Luddite, and I have a cell phone, and I think they can be great, and I think it's wonderful. I talk to my mom as well and my dad on the phone, but I think the problem is it's a question of degree, and you hear this from a lot of university professors and so on, that the kids come out, as soon as they come out of the lecture hall, they're on the phone and they're constantly talking to the mother ship, and I think that there's, again, it's about balance. That sometimes you've just got to work things out without talking to your parents, I think. And it's a difficult thing to do, especially if you have been so close and so managed for so many years. It's not an easy habit to break, but I think it's something we should be aspiring to, is that we have a less constant line of communication open, maybe, with them. And we had an earlier caller, Gary, talking about that, I think, and his daughter calls him, at difficult moments, but she's not calling him all the time, as she can stand on her own two feet. And I guess that's what we want to be steering our children towards.
Did you talk to any parents who consider that a problem, that they just can't find any peace on the planet because they're constantly being called by their kids?
Yeah, I did actually. I talked to one mother who started putting on a call divert for her son at college because he was just calling way too often. And I've certainly heard from a lot of parents who despair that their mid 25-year-old is still living in the bedroom and wanting to get driven to the cinema and stuff. And obviously kids now come out of college with big debts, and there are other reasons to be living at home in your 20s. But I think for many of them, it's just that that is the place where they have been the center of everyone's universe. It's very easy, and they just kind of settle back into it.
This is a very interesting book, even though I'm not a parent. I was very interested. The title again is Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting by Carl Honoré. He's been our guest this hour. We only have a minute or so left, Carl, but there was one other point you made I wanted to ask you about. Athletic kids are overtrained and wearing out. Injuries formerly seen in college and professional athletes are now rife in high school, increasingly among 9 and 10-year-olds. What is going on here? We're destroying our children.
We are, and we're destroying them with again, coming back to what we said at the very beginning of the program, we're destroying them with love, almost. We're in some ways, we're kind of killing the thing we love because we're just pushing too hard, we're wanting too much, we're getting over-invested, and this whole culture of more is more and earlier is better, you see it writ large in youth sports now, that kids play all year round, they specialize at young ages, they play harder, they train harder, and their bodies can't cope. They simply can't cope. And you're starting to see kids, turning up with ACL joint tears and ligament trouble and the kind of things you just never saw in 9 and 10-year-olds, or, pitcher's elbow, tennis. These things are now rife, and I think it's a warning sign. It's a signal that, as a culture, we need to ease off. We are under pressure. We're putting the children under too much pressure, and it's time just to back off and take a deep breath and let things happen without jumping in and trying to make them happen.
As far as what to do, where do we go from here, I like this line. Instead of baking a cake with your children because it'll teach them about weight, volume, and arithmetic, do it for the sheer joy of it. Leave the developmental payoff to take care of itself. Well,
yes.
That's a good way to wrap it up, and we are out of time. I want to thank our listeners, our callers, and our guest, Carl Honoré. his book, Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. Stay with us after the news. We'll talk about a reporter's year-long study of a single hospital and how it's handling the pressures of the U.S. healthcare system. On listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.